But now on BBC Radio 4, Desert Island Discs with Kirsty Young.
My castaway this week is the singer-songwriter and composer Randy Newman. He is a master of modern American music. His peers regard him as standing shoulder to shoulder with the likes of Cole Porter and George Gershwin. They say he may well be the greatest living songwriter that America has produced, though his high satirical style with songs like Short People have sometimes got him into hot water. His film scores have won him an Academy Award and numerous Grammys. Yet despite this, the man himself is typically downbeat about the appeal of his acutely elegiac lyricism and soaring movie soundtracks. He says simply, "I've been a pretty good musician." Being a pretty good musician
what
was...
I said?
You did say that.
Yeah.
Are you happy with that now?
Yeah. I'm a very good, probably qualified with a probably composer, that I would say.
And I've also heard, and I'm not sure if this is true, that you don't really relish being interviewed.
No, I like being interviewed. This was the most difficult sort of preparation for any interview I've ever done. This was hard, really.
Because of the age.
It made me think, I wouldn't take any music.
Why? Because it's better to have nothing than to just have
Well, because the thing is, it's never been exactly where I went for relaxation, you know. I'd watch television. Or when I go to sleep at night, I like a voice going on that isn't my own. So, you know, I end up listening to, actually, the BBC News, which they have on at like 1 in the morning there.
So that's you listen to the World Service to get you up.
I listen to the World Service as I go to sleep, yeah.
And what about, this is also, I mean, with somebody like you who has this legendary status within music, we think we know the person, we don't really know the person. You seem pretty affable to me. You have a reputation for being grumpy.
No, I'm not grumpy as a person, I don't think. Never have been. I mean, people figure I'm grumpy because I'm, you know, from my songs where I'm not... sunshine and moonbeams and rainbows particularly.
So you think you're a pretty upbeat guy?
Upbeat? No. I would say upbeat, but in general, hello and thank you and friendly, not let me out of here.
And what about this obsessiveness that you elicit in fans? I mean, people who like you really, really, really like you. You know, they wait often for years, as we know, for these new albums to come out.
Well, for that, I'm sorry. I mean, I should have produced more than I did. Schubert only lived to be 31. I mean, I'm sorry to use my name in the same sentence, but I mean, he lived to be like 31. And I think he did more in his last year than I've done. And he was sick. I don't know why that is, but I wish that I'd produced more.
Well, let's start by taking you through these painful choices. What's your first track that you've chosen today?
The first track is one of the late Beethoven quartets. They're all great, everything he wrote almost. This is 135 in F major with the Hollywood String Quartet, played in the studio orchestra at 20th Century Fox. And I worked with a few of them. And many people think that their versions of the late Beethoven quartets are the best versions. And that would make it, since it's some of the best music ever written, about the best thing that ever came out of Hollywood, unless you like movies.
Thank you.
The Hollywood String Quartet, playing part of the third movement of Beethoven's String Quartet No. 16 in F major, and chosen not just because of the perfection of the music, but because, indeed, the players are personal to you, people that you had known and worked with.
Some of it's faster than that. I should have picked something like No Milk Today. But they were great musicians, and I was lucky to hear them when I was a little boy. I didn't know that they were sort of world-renowned, but they were people I knew, and they made this great record.
Let's talk then about this extraordinary musical dynasty that you were born into. Your father was one of six brothers, and how many of the brothers were involved in making music in Hollywood?
There were seven brothers. Three of them were film composers, and the third one, I don't know how much composing he did, but he conducted, and he conducted really well, Amel. Anyway, Alfred won 9 Academy Awards and did How Green Was My Valley and almost all the Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals, King and I.
And your father was a doctor?
He was a doctor, yeah. He was the only one who went to school.
Yeah, he went to university.
He went past the fourth grade. I think Alfred, who was the oldest brother, wanted him to be a doctor. I think he may have wanted to be a musician. I don't know. He played clarinet. He had a band at the University of Alabama called Newman and the New Maniacs. I think that's where his heart was, really.
And he wanted you to do what his brothers had done. He saw that.
He never said that.
Right.
But I think he did. It looked like a great life to him from the outside. He thought it was just the highest art form, film music, I think. And he admired his brothers a great deal, and he thought that would be a great thing to be.
I get the impression he was a very big character, a strong character.
He took up a lot of room. My mother kind of got squashed, I think. Every time I did talk to her about something substantive, she made a lot of sense and helped. But my father would jump in. So, I didn't get to hear her finish much of what she was thinking about.
Your father was away, is that right, in the first few years of your life? You were down in the South with your mother.
Yeah, in New Orleans, yeah.
What do you remember about New Orleans?
I remember the heat. I remember that it was like the other place. It was very different. The manners, of course, is different, slower.
And you have a Southern accent. You definitely don't have an L.A. accent.
My mother did. I have a little one, I think.
Okay.
My mother never lost hers.
So what attracted your mom and your dad to each other if he was this sort of big...
Well, they were beautiful-looking people. He looked like Robert Donat, the British film star. He'd sign autographs.
What did your mother look like?
She looked like a Southern belle. That was... hairstyle and things like that, but I sometimes think that she might have been happier if she'd stayed down in New Orleans. She got treated differently there, but they loved each other in the way. They really did.
And your father was a doctor to, very well-known Hollywood people.
Yeah, he was. My brother became a doctor, and he became an oncologist because he wanted his people to really be sick. My dad says, look, 50% of the people that come to me, they're not sick, but they think they're sick, so you got to treat them as if they were, and he did. He treated the Rolling Stones when they were in town, as I remember. And I said, well, what were they like? He said, they're the whitest people I've ever seen. That was his assessment.
And is it true that you woke up one day to find a piano in the corner of your bedroom?
All of a sudden, there it was, as if, in case I were Mozart, I'd have a piano to prove it on.
Tell me then about your next piece of music.
Is the Goodbye from How Green Was My Valley, which was composed by Alfred and is one of his best scores, I think.
Thank you.
advise from How Green Was My Valley, composed and conducted by Alfred Newman, your uncle who won, was it 9 Oscars?
9, yeah.
You yourself have won one Oscar,
yeah.
And been nominated how many times?
16, I think.
Did it matter then when you eventually won, or were you so sick of the whole thing it didn't?
I didn't think it would matter, because I know that the merit is not necessarily what wins those things. But then I got out there, and the orchestra was standing. It really touched me that they would do that, because they told them not to. They told me later. And the audience was standing up, and I said, you know, if you're so happy about it, why didn't you give it to me a long time ago? I don't want your sympathy. But I thought, I was kind of choking up, and I said, my God, you know, I'll never live it down if I, like, break down up here at something like this shallow. So I pulled myself together there and took it and went. But it really surprised me, shocked me, that I was so moved by this, you know, because it's not meaning. I mean, it'll be the first sentence of my obituary, no doubt about it, no matter what I do. The second sentence will be about short people. But, you know, it's not the song. It was almost the least worthy thing I've ever had nominated, maybe. But there you go.
I want to find out more about your uncles, because I get the feeling that, as well as your father being a big character, your uncles were too, and you really saw and learned a lot about not just Hollywood, but more importantly about music from them. I mean, you used to go on set, didn't you, with your uncle Al?
Go on stage, yeah.
Right. And would this be when he was conducting in front of the screen?
Yeah, in front of the screen.
So the movie's showing.
At the Fox soundstage, yeah.
And a proper orchestra, a full orchestra he
would be conducting. Yeah. Some of the same people who played on the Beethoven played on that, maybe all of them.
What did that look like to you as a little boy? What impression?
Well, it must
did it
have
make?
Impressed me. The sound of it certainly did. It was a great orchestra to have in my ear at that time. I was very lucky.
And your uncle Alfred was, it sounds like, something of a, maybe not a tortured soul, but somebody for whom his work was not an enjoyable process.
I don't know. He seemed as if he weren't happy. He'd work every day from 9 to 5. I never saw him do anything else. Then he'd have a drink and have a few more, and ultimately, I guess, go to bed. And that was what his life was like.
Let's take a break for your next piece of music. What is it?
The next piece of music is George Jones singing The Door.
And why have you chosen this?
I love George Jones. I love his voice. You know, in high school, I was too backward to have girlfriends, really, many of them anyway. Any, to tell the truth. But I remember I broke up with somebody later in life, and it hurt. And I couldn't believe that billions of people had gone through this. And I remember driving around listening to George Jones, and all of a sudden I realized, well, all these crummy lyrics, you know, things that would have embarrassed me about how saccharine they were, they really kind of hit home. You realize, well, the whole repertoire is based on songs like that. I'd never noticed. I just thought it stunk. But when you're in a state like that, that stuff kind of resonates. More than that, it rips your guts out. And he's a great artist, a great singer.
I've heard the sound of my dear old mama crying, and the sound of a train that took me off to war, and the awful sound of a thousand bombs exploding, and I wondered if I could take it anymore. There were times when they almost drove me crazy, but I did my best, I took it like a man. But who would think in my lonely one sound in the world my heart can't stand, to hear that sound and to know it's real. Through tear-stained eyes I watched her walk away. And of earthquake storms, guns and wars, Lord, nothing has ever hurt me more than that lonely sound, the closing of the door.
George Jones and The Door. You said that you were kind of backward in school when it came to romance. Why? Were you shy?
Yeah, I think I've always been shy. Maybe it's my eyes, you know. My eyes, they don't fuse. You know, I see double, like I see two of you. So I tended not to look people in the eye. And that made it difficult to say, hey, would you like to go to the dance with me? Or, you know, I think.
When did you start composing?
First thing I got paid for, I was like 16, I think, 16, 17.
Who were you writing for?
Gene McDaniels, I think, or I was just writing. Every step I've made, sort of major thing, except performing, I was kind of pulled or pushed into it. A friend of mine, Lenny Warnker, was really interested in pop music, and I was studying, you know, harmony and counterpoint and classical music. And I like pop music plenty. I listen to it all the time. And he said, why don't you try and write some songs? So I did, and they were sort of okay.
Did you take one of your songs to Frank Sinatra? It's
yeah,
Lonely at the Top.
He did. Me and Lenny went to see him. I wrote it for him. I thought it'd be funny if he did a song like Lonely at the Top, which is someone whining about, oh, even though I'm famous and I have everything, it's lonely. And I thought it'd be kind of hip if he did something like that. But he didn't. But he
did you meet face to face?
He was like pretending to read music, and he was playing Think It's Gonna Rain and talking about minor key and things like that. It was funny to see that kind of insecurity. I mean, maybe it was lonely at the time.
And so there came a point when you just got sick of writing, I mean, the straightforward, borderline corny stuff.
And I was actually writing a song for Frank Sinatra Jr. at the time when I wrote Simon Smith. And I did. I just had a lyric that had care and there, and a bear got in there, and I just took off in the direction I ended up.
And how did that feel when you finished it, when you looked at the piece? And I mean, it's so different.
It made
so
me laugh. Right. I mean, I didn't like it better than anything I'd written, because I was proud of things I'd written before that, but it was different. And I just always thought, why not have the latitude a short story writer has? I mean, you know, Alice Munro or William Trevor, they don't have to be William Trevor, Alice Munro in their short stories. They never are. And why do we have to be that? But it's what I felt comfortable with. Now I learn that it's probably because of shyness.
More about that in just a second. Tell me about your next piece of music.
The next piece of music is Fletcher Henderson and his band with Stampede. In some of these things by Henderson around 1927, 1929, there's like five good ideas in a piece. I don't know whether it was the arranger or the tune itself, but they're my favorites.
Thank you.
That was Fletcher Henderson and his band with the Stampede. You were talking there before we heard that choice about this writing in character, which, of course, people love you for, and you've written in the character.
Yes, some do. But
well,
I mean,
the people who love you love the fact that you do that, because it's an unusual thing. As we were saying, music is usually, you know, I love you, you love me, we're happy together, you don't love me, you're breaking my heart. Blah,
that's
blah,
what
blah.
People want from it. And that's what it... And great writers have functioned doing that, you know.
And you have functioned by writing from the point of view of it could be a slave master, it could be a sex addict, it could be a child killer at its worst. I mean, you've really... You've plumbed the depths of what humans are capable of in your songs.
People sort of don't like it.
Does that bother you?
No, it doesn't bother me. I wouldn't have it any differently.
Did you ever want to be that sort of star?
No. I'd often think something that I wrote was a hit, and I'd play it for someone, and they'd look at me like I was crazy, you know. I mean, that's a hit. But I always wanted to sell records. I always think, well, this isn't hard to understand. You know, it's not Joyce.
What about writing in the third person then? You alluded to the fact that maybe now you're coming around to the idea that it has partly been a shield from letting people see
maybe
who you
are. Maybe it is. I'm not ashamed of saying anything about myself. I'd answer anything that you asked. So I don't think I'm reticent about that. And lately I've been doing more stuff that's closer to being biographical than I've done, because that's where I'm finding the stuff. I'd take a song wherever I found it. I wouldn't care whether it hurt me or those close to me or anyone. It's life and death to me.
You did say that in a song where you wrote, being married to your second wife, you wrote something of a bittersweet.
Yeah, that's what that song's
love
about.
Love song
actually.
to your first wife.
No one's ever noticed that. It says, I'd sell my soul and your soul for a song. That's what I mean about it. I said, I would do this, is what it's saying. And it says, and I wanted you to know, you're saying all this stuff about how you miss someone that you should have been nice to 25 years ago. So writing a love song for your first wife while married to the second one.
How did that go down?
My wife I'm married to now asked me not to play it when she was at a show. And I can't remember whether I did or not. It's really a good song, I might have, but I didn't need it.
Tell me about your next piece of music then.
Next piece of music is part of Sacrificial Dance from The Rite of Spring by Stravinsky.
And what is it about this?
Well, Stravinsky is a big deal, important deal. Those three pieces he wrote in the early part of the last century, The Rite of Spring, Petrushka, and Firebird. They're tremendous pieces, The Rite of Spring particularly. He was a great composer. It was one of those things, you know. I mean, you leave Shostakovich off, you put him on, or Bartok's not on my list anymore. I didn't know what the hell to do. This is bad. It's nice talking to you. But I mean, this was difficult.
We've put you through hell.
Well, kind of.
Let's hear it.
Yeah.
Part of the Sacrificial Dance from Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, played by the Boston Philharmonic Orchestra. orchestra conducted by Benjamin Zander. You said there will be two top lines when you pop off. They will be about the fact that you won an Oscar and that you wrote Short People.
That's right.
I can't avoid but ask you about Short People. Of course, it was this a satire on the absurdities of prejudice. You were writing and singing about...
I mean, that's what I ended up saying. But it was about someone who was crazy. It was nothing. I'd say... It reached people whom I normally don't reach, you know, on top 40 radio in the U.S. And so disc jockey would call me with one of those voices. He'd talk like this regularly. He'd say, "Now, Randy Newman, this song, Short People, has caused a lot of controversy. It's about prejudice, isn't it?" And I'd say, "Yeah, it's about prejudice." "Well, thank you." And da, da, da. "So you don't really hate short people, do you?" And I said, "No, but I'm getting it." I didn't say that. But it was just about a guy who was, there's no cabal against short people. I mean, he was just nuts, that's all.
So it was written from the point of view of somebody who was just irrational?
Yeah.
And you, because you thought that was funny?
Yeah, I do. Little cars that go beep, 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 little voices going beep, beep, beep. I thought it was funny, and I didn't know people were so sensitive.
But is it true your concerts were picketed?
Yeah, by little people. You know? And I got a death threat, too, in Memphis. And my manager said, "You know, I used to be in the road with the Carpenters, that this would happen to them all the time." And I said, "Really?" And he said, "Yeah, yeah, you know, about once every three concerts, they get a death threat." So I said, "Okay." So I went out there and did it. When I was done, I said to him, I said, "That was, you know, it was pretty good that I did that. It was kind of brave, actually, you know, because I was thinking about getting shot." And he said, "Yeah, you know, you had your head behind the mic for half of the show." And then I said, "Oh, did the Carpenters really get that many death threats?" He said, "No. I just tell them to you so you go on."
But you're still here. And the satire now, a lot of the satire, I mean, some of it you've written quite a while back seems more apposite now than ever it did. I'm thinking particularly about songs like Political Science and A Few Words in Defense of My Country. I mean, America is not around the globe universally loved these days. And how long ago was it you were writing these songs? And give people a sample of what you were saying in
those songs. Political Science is a song, again, about going further than anyone would go. Now, I don't know what the name of that, whether it's satire or irony. I think it's satire, maybe. But it's, you know, no one likes us. I don't know why. We may not be perfect, but heaven knows we try. But all around, even our old friends put us down. Let's drop the big one and see what happens. Now, again, there's nobody that nuts. But there is a jingoism in America, and always has been. Nationalism gone a little bit too far. So I did write that. And now they don't laugh in Europe at that song.
Tell me about your next piece of music, then.
It's the beginning of Shostakovich's 15th Symphony. Some of the things I like this piece, are when composers are sort of beyond caring about public or anything else. And this sounds like Shostakovich was writing for himself.
The beginning of Shostakovich's Symphony No. 15, played by the London Philharmonic, conducted by Bernard Haitink. So, Randy Newman, you put off, you resisted going into the family business, well, I call it the family business, composing scores for the movies for quite a long time. What was the first one that you worked on?
The first picture I did was a picture called Cold Turkey, and it was about a town that was quitting smoking. And I turned down a lot of pictures, but I'm not sure I was wrong in the ones I turned down. I used to make my choices on what I was going to do, on how important music would be to the picture. If I didn't account for anything, I didn't do it.
I'm thinking, of course, when you say that about Toy Story 1 and 2,
yeah.
you lent an extraordinary amount of, pathos and depth to a film that was a beautifully animated film,
yeah.
But the music was a significant part of the story that was delivered.
It turned out, irrespective of how much the music meant to it, I hope it meant a lot, those are good pictures.
And the albums that we talked about earlier, where you are singing and songwriting, have mm-hmm. been few and far between. Do you find it easier, maybe, to write when you've got a deadline and when you've got a script and when you've got people calling you every day to say, where is it? Where's the score?
Well, you have no choice about it. Discipline is imposed from without.
Yeah.
And I have to go in there. I have to work.
But is the process enjoyable for you, or is it a tortured process?
When I'm going good, it's all right. When I don't know what to do, it's tortured for a moment. If I only had the ability to look ahead at consequences, I mean, I'd realize that things are going to turn out okay. I mean, I've done it so many times that I know I'm going to get an idea that'll get me out of this scene. And I know that I'm going to write another song because I've written 100 before. And if I take this drug, I'm going to feel awful tomorrow. Worse, the low will be worse than the highest. But I've never been able to look ahead like that.
And what about your uncle? You said that he would compose from 9 till 5 every day, then he'd go and have a drink, and then he'd compose the next day. I mean, do you need
he'd
to...
He'd turn the chair around and have a drink. At
right.
5 o'clock, bam. Used to call it post time. You know, there were a lot of that in my family.
And do you need to do that?
I don't do it. I never liked alcohol that much. There's like minor substance abuse. There's some genetic substance abuse rattling around in the family, it would seem.
Because I'm thinking of L.A. famously as a town which is, you know, you're either A.A. and N.A. and in
There's
bed at 9 o'clock at night, or you're out in the Viper rooms forgetting what you did last night. It is a city of extremes, is it not?
Yeah, there is those two extremes. Cocaine really cut a hole in pop music in Los Angeles. A few missing years in people's lives.
But not in yours. Did you manage to
avoid
that?
No, I never liked cocaine that much. I never liked alcohol particularly. I never really loved anything but pain medication. That includes my family.
And the doctor's son, too,
mm-hmm.
yes. There is something appropriate in that.
Maybe. I had a doctor tell me once, he said, maybe that's a connection to your father. Because he'd give me stuff, you know, like amphetamines. He said, everyone else is taking them. You know, as a composer, he didn't want me to get behind the other composers, you know. So it sounds awful now, but it was different time. You know, it was like he lived in the age where they discovered penicillin and those miracle drugs, and he just loved that kind of magic that medicine could do. And I think he knew that it was psychological with if you took amphetamines to write, as a lot of the guys did, you get to thinking if you don't have them, you can't write. And of course it's not true. Kids, if there are any of you still left, it's not true. No.
Tell me about your next piece of music, then.
I love Mahler, and the Adagio of the Ninth is representative of him, and it's a great piece.
part of the Adagio from Mahler's Ninth Symphony, played by the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. So right now, you have a new album. Are you working on new music for a movie, or is it just one thing at a time for you?
Well, I like to do one thing at a time. I can do more. I'm doing songs for a Disney movie called The Frog Princess.
How do you find dealing with big Hollywood? I mean, with a corporation like Disney? Is that, I think, because you are something of a part-time rebel. I'm wondering how you get on with big corporate America.
Well, truthfully, I get along. I don't have like a knee-jerk reaction to big corp. You know, hate them automatically. They're human beings. They're people, more or less. But the process is different. With Disney, I like getting assignments. It's the easiest thing that I do is write songs on which I've given the parameters and an assignment. And I'm proud of the songs I've done. You try and find the guys to work for, I do, because I've had the luxury of doing so since I also do something else. Guys you can stand to be in the same room with and who are on the same wavelength musically as you are.
Can you stand to be in the same room with yourself? Because, of course, I'm going to send you away to this desert island. Will you be comfortable with your own company?
Yeah, I think I'll get there. I'll figure it out, because I have to.
How are you at home? I mean, do you like to fill your... If you're not having to sit down at the blank score and compose, do you sort of fill your life, or are you one of these people who can sit and stare out the window?
I mean, I've had children since I was 23.
You have five children?
Yeah.
Three from your first marriage, two from your second.
So I've spent a lot of time with them and thinking about them and talking about them and stuff. So that's been what my life has been about. I mean, my brother just retired from medicine. He's younger than I. And he has hobbies. He and his wife are pals. Now, I don't know whether my wife's my pal or not. And I don't have any hobbies. I don't know what I do.
And you're 65 this year. So
yeah, this year.
Can you imagine stopping writing ever?
I think I can, but it's how I judge myself.
Harshly, I imagine.
Not harshly. No, I think this last record I made is the best record I made. And the one before that I thought was the second best. In fact, I'm sure of it. I don't care what anyone says in something like that. If I didn't think so, if I thought I was getting appreciably worse and really sliding, I wouldn't do it anymore. I mean, I wish I'd done more. What can I say? You know, I've done three albums in 20 years. I mean, that's pathetic, you know? It really is. And I'll try and do better. What can I say?
This from a man who says he's not harsh on himself. Tell me about your final piece of music.
Final piece of music is Ray Charles singing Come Rain or Come Shine. You know, this may have been my favorite record. I mean, I don't know how many records I've bought, that non-classical records, but it's not 50. And this record I loved, and I loved him, loved him.
I'm gonna love you like no one's loved you. Come rain or come shine. High as a mountain, deep as a river. Come rain or come shine. I guess when you met me, it was just a one of those things. But don't ever bet me, 'cause I'm gonna be true. Well, if you let me, you're gonna love me like no one's loved me. Come rain or come shine.
Ray Charles singing Come Rain or Come Shine. So I am going to give you, Randy Newman, the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare, and you're allowed to take another book. What's your book going to be?
I think I'd take Dante's The Divine Comedy in Italian with an English translation, and I'd try and translate it. I understand some Italian, and I guess I'd have enough time to pick up a little more.
And what would your luxury be? Something to make life a little more bearable?
An Italian dictionary?
No. It's your choice.
I guess I'd take a piano and then I'd practice and see how good I could get at it.
We'll give you the piano. And even worse than asking you to pick eight, I'm now going to ask you to pick one. If the waves were to wash to the shore and threaten to take all your discs away, which one would you want to save?
I think I'd take the late Beethoven quartets. It's a lot of music and I could really look at it hard. It's funny how, you know, on my desert island, I'm trying to work myself. You know, I think I'm going to have to think of a way to fill that time. But also, you can't go wrong with it. It's great music.
Okay, you may have that. Randy Newman, thank you very much for letting us hear your desert island discs.
It's been great talking to you, but it was terrible getting ready for this thing.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Me too.
Young's castaway next week is the singer Ian Bostridge. Desert Island Discs was created by Roy Plumley. The producer is Jane Thurlow.